Breakfast puppies?
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars, but mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Hey, Xander, what are we drinking tonight?
We are drinking George Dickel Tennessee Sour Mash Whiskey Superior Number 12 Recipe and everybody's local lager.
Oh, crap.
I did just
that was almost a party foul. No, good catch there.
All in the beard. All in the beard.
Hey, everybody, you're listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. As usual, this is Nathaniel.
Just Jacob.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
So Xander, tell us a little bit about these drinks.
All right. So I'm a big fan of George Dickel rye whiskey. It is one of my favorite affordable ryes, but I haven't really had much of, I hadn't had any of the other bourbons, or their Tennessee whiskeys rather. So I thought, I'll get this. And then we also have Everybody's Brewing, which is up just across the Columbia River in White Salmon, Washington, which is a cute little town.
Yep.
Everybody's Brewing local lager.
Local lager lager.
Yeah, L-O-G-G-E-R.
Oh, lager, like, yeah, like local, we have with the Timbers and all that stuff. Yeah.
Local lager lager.
Clever.
Because English is not confusing. So, Superior Number 12. Our Superior Number 12 has rich depths of flavor, perfectly balanced with Dickel's signature smooth finish. The rich flavors of Number 12 come from resting our whiskey in oak barrels for years longer than our classic Number 8 blend. In this smooth finishing 90 proof whiskey, you'll find flavors of rich oak and subtle vanilla with hints of sweetness and smoke. So I couldn't find how long George Dickel Number 12 is actually aged for. I heard estimates between 6 and 12 years. Being a Tennessee whiskey, I believe it has to be at least 4, but it says years longer, so a minimum of 6 would make sense. Mash bill, 84% corn, 8% rye, 8% malted barley. As for our local lager, it is at a very crisp 4.8%. Nice and light for hot summer days like we've been having. IBU at a very, very paltry 25.
Summer has finally started here in Portland, Oregon. I suddenly feel like the sun exists again, and it has decided to let us know quite loudly.
Yes.
It doesn't even taste like 25 IBU. I really enjoy this.
I'm sorry, I'm an idiot. What is IBU?
International Bitterness Units.
There are bitterness units, and they are international.
Yes.
Okay, what are they?
So basically, when you have something super light, like a Pilsner or a lager like this, for instance, generally, the IBU is going to be pretty low, you know, and also most stouts are going to be like, you know, 5, 10. Hefeweizen's going to be, you know, 10, 15. They're pretty low. When you have a pale ale, you're getting up into like the 30, maybe 40 range for a really hoppy pale ale. And then when you get to really, really kind of bitter IPAs, you're looking at like 60, 70.
Goddamn Pacific Northwest, 100-plus IBUs.
100-plus IBUs. I've had a couple of those before, too. So basically, the higher the IBU, the more bitter the beer is going to be.
I had read an interesting article that I actually don't think I'm going to be able to find and link. I'm sorry. That talked about Portland's obsession with hops and how frequently hops are overused by amateur brewers to disguise weak flavor.
That sounds like why bitterness was initially put into beer to begin with.
I'll pull two exceptions on that. One, it goes well beyond Portland. The entire Pacific Northwest is riddled with an obsession for IBUs, the way Texas is riddled with an obsession for Schofield heat units and chili. and it's not just amateur brewers. I mean, I've sat in a bar talking to two brewmasters who are waxing poetic on exactly how much hops they can put into a batch and still get it to turn out something that's humanly drinkable.
Yeah, it just kind of seems like a dick measuring contest after a while for no really good or apparent reason.
Yeah.
And again, on the summertime, something super bitter like that's really hard to drink. So something like this, I think, is actually quite nice as a change of place, pace from what I actually usually go with, which are IPAs.
This is very pleasant. And the whiskey, I've never had this before, George Dickel. It is actually pretty tasty. And you said this was like the low price stuff on the shelf that you went for?
It was on sale. It's normally, I think, $23. So I got it for $20.
Gee, that's really good.
This is good for $20 whiskey.
That's
really good.
What I was thinking was like,
And the flavors actually blend in well. Like when I take a sip of the whiskey and I follow it with a sip of the beer, it's pretty solid.
So you want to do Boilermakers again?
No, I'm not pouring the beer into the whiskey. I'm not fucking Jaeger bombing this, but I do like the alternate back and forth flavor mix.
Well, and then I think that's also a really nice thing to have in any kind of a dive bar setting, too, is something that's nice and light and mixed in with a whiskey that's not super expensive, and being able to actually go and have both of them, you know, together in one lovely combination and swoop.
Well, I'm sure we'll have more to say about this when we get to the bar portion of our evening. But for now, on to the show.
On to the show. Let's take this to the road. Hey, Jacob, I understand you went on a ride recently.
Yeah. Last Thursday, I and four other people headed out from Portland nice and early, headed for Eastern Washington.
Everyone on motorcycles?
Everybody on motorcycles. Nice. We did have a Sagwagon following us for half the way, but...
what was that?
A what?
Yeah.
A Sagwagon?
I thought you said a sad wagon.
I guess they're sad they got to drive the wagon.
The person who was driving the Sagwagon was very sad because their Triumph Daytona is currently having some mechanical difficulty and could not make the trip, so they drove the Sagwagon.
I understand that's kind of par for the course with Triumphs.
Yeah, unless it's like a Speed Triple or a T100, everything else is a little bit fiddly.
It's kind of like when I watch The Walking Dead, I wonder why this guy is riding around in the apocalypse on a Triumph when he should be riding on something a little bit more standard KLR. And local. Yeah.
So what is a Sagwagon and why does it make you sad to be in the Sagwagon?
Well, to reverse the order, why are you sad to be in a Sagwagon? Because you're not riding.
Okay. That makes sense.
You're in the cage. You are submitting to the culture of the cage.
Boo.
Boo. That said, the Sagwagon is a term that can mean one of two things. It can either mean any four-wheeled vehicle that's following along a motorcycle convoy. The other thing it can mean is a dedicated support vehicle. They're frequently used for sport bike rallies and that sort of thing because they don't have cargo capacity, so people need to put their overnight bags somewhere. But it's also handy because you have someone who can help riders who have mechanical failures. You can throw some of the larger spare parts, that sort of thing. So that's what happens. In this particular case, it was strictly because we had a friend who couldn't come with us because their bike was down.
Does every ride like that need a Sagwagon?
No. Most of the time I ride, I don't have one.
And this guy just wanted to come along with you guys.
Yep,
so
she did. So yeah.
So she volunteered to...
Yeah, she wanted to come with and she wanted to follow us and she was staying at the same places, so...
Right okay. on.
That makes sense. At least you kind of still could be part of the action.
Yeah. So anyways, we headed out of Portland and went up into Eastern Washington, avoiding every major highway.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah. No, it was through a bunch of twisty roads. There is a section that we took that I am not allowed to disclose on air just because the people we got the route from don't want it to become overrun with people. However, if you contact me at Just Jacob on Facebook and prove your riding credentials, I'll send you the map.
Secrets.
So we did several hundred miles the first day and pulled into Wenatchee, which is a wonderful little town just on the east side of the mountains.
Oh, I know. It's in one of my favorite songs.
What song is that?
Blue Wing by Tom Russell.
Okay. Ooh.
They mentioned Wenatchee.
It had a great dinner at the winery there, which name escapes me, unfortunately. And got up the next morning and rode to Spokane. Stayed at the Oxford Suites there. Shout out to the Oxford Suites. They took really good care of us. And we attended an event in town that was the purpose of the trip. And then Sunday morning, bright and early, I and two others bombed all the way back from Spokane via the freeway system to Portland.
Did you have to go through Seattle?
No, straight down to the gorge and then up the gorge.
Okay. Oh, God.
But even...
I-5 sucks in that area. Oh, yeah. No, so bad.
Yeah, it would have taken us longer to go over to I-5 and down. But even when we were on the freeway in Eastern Washington, it's beautiful out there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's you're in high desert country, and it's that sort of high desert country where you look at the horizon and you get that feeling that you are so far above sea level that the sky is going to go below that horizon. And it's just a wonderful thing. Unfortunately, I barely made it home. By the time I got home, both of my front forks were nearly black with fork oil because no rips or tears, but I had some really bad seepage.
So clearly fork oil is like blinker fluid. You can just buy it at Napa, right?
Yeah, you can buy it at Napa.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You really can.
You really can. All right. Yeah. Fork oil is a thing.
Oh, it is a thing.
It is okay. A thing. Okay. This makes an interesting lead-in. So, Nathaniel, how much maintenance do you do on your own motorcycle?
Almost none, because only recently has it come out of me paying for it. And part of the contract of me getting the loan and paying for the bike was that it had to continually be worked on by a professional mechanic.
Yeah, so just like bicycles, motorcycles, when it comes to maintenance, people have very different tolerances for what they're willing to work on. And for me, I'm willing to do just about anything on my bikes, with the exception of fork seals. They're such a fiddly, messy, pain in the ass job that when I go to the shop, I know they're charging me an amount of money to make me not bring the job to them because they don't want to do it either. But it's still worth my time to pay them the exorbitant amount of money to change out my fork seals. So, like, Xander, how much bicycle maintenance do you do on your own?
I don't do very much because I don't have a lot of the tools, but I did recently buy brand new brakes for my bicycle that enable me to just literally pull a pin out, slide out the old brake pad, slide in nice. The new one, and put the pin back in. So I do those types of things. You know, I definitely do some basic cleaning and those types of things. But I don't have a stand, so I can't like hold it up or anything. But you know, like I will add new lubricants to it and tighten the bells and whistles and those types of things. So enough to do most of the basics. But having ridden 7 days straight between my apartment in inner southeast Portland to Edgefield, 14 miles away. 7 days in a row, I did like 200 miles in 7 days. And because of that, I broke a spoke. My chain was about to deteriorate. And those types of things I didn't really want to do myself.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can understand. I mean, the moment you break a spoke, unless you have a bicycle maintenance shop in your garage, that one's going into the shop. You know, there's those things. But yeah, I mean, like I grew up learning to fix engines and motorcycles. And I mean, the reason I know as much about as I do is because mom and dad and my collection of uncles and uncles by kith drug me over and made sure I learned.
They drugged you?
Drugged me.
Oh.
Drugged me over. They drugged me over.
Wow. That's a hardcore mechanic family.
Well, yes, it was in both senses. I really enjoy doing maintenance, and I really encourage people to push themselves to do a little bit more. But at the same time, Everybody's got their fork seals. Everybody's got their fork seals. The things they just don't want to mess with.
There's just the one. There's always the one thing where you're just like, you know what? Take the money. I don't care. I don't want to deal with this.
Yep.
I'm that way with my bicycle and my motorcycle. I can do basic, minor bicycle maintenance. I mean, I know how to adjust certain things. I'm still not. I don't trust myself to true a wheel. But I can, you know, I can remove a non-quick release set of wheels and replace it. I know how to fix a flat. I'm not real. I could not tell you the size of my rims. And
I couldn't either.
Yeah.
Because I don't care.
With my motorcycle, I'm just, all right, I have a problem. Taking it to the shop. Always. It's new enough. It's fancy enough with the Rebel that we had, and my old CM450, I did a lot of work on this myself. I mean, they were just grease and carbureted. It went and grease, carburetors, chains, much simpler than fuel injection and a shaft drive.
Timing's a bitch.
So the maintenance that you had to do yourself on this trip, you said that you almost didn't make it back?
Almost didn't make it back.
How did that go down?
So what happened is on the way out, I noticed that I was having a lot of oil residue above my fork seal on the front fork. And there is a problem with many strikers of the 2011 through 2013 years where their fork seals and dust seals are a little bit persnickety and are prone to seeping and leaking. I recently found out about a quick fix for them. It's called a Seal Keeper, and it's a $5 piece of equipment that you just run around your fork seal every so often. And I've had a huge endorsement from a professional mechanic who said it probably because he never wants to see my bike in the shop for another fork seal job. What ended up happening is you have to keep the part of the fork right above the dust seal and fork seal clean on strikers. Otherwise, it'll suck dirt into the fork seal, which causes space for oil to leak up. And as it leaks up and then down the fork and then all over your brake assembly and onto your wheel. And mine never got past the seeping point until the very end. The problem is that fork seals do take time to do, so it's not something you can do on the side of the road because you have to basically disassemble your entire front forks. you know, if you found a shop in the middle this time of year, you'd have to be waiting 3 days before they could get around to it or pay an exorbitant amount of money. I mean, in Portland, if you can get your fork seals done for about $300, you're doing pretty good.
Wow.
That's labor and parts. Because it's a fairly involved process. It's not just just replacing some seals. It's totally deconstructing the fork, checking for wear, potentially replacing your load springs, refilling with oil, and then seating the seals, which is an incredible job. And there's lots of things that can go wrong, and you have to start all over again.
So you got it all settled up, though.
Yeah, I mean,
you're all good now.
It will be. I limped it back home, and I didn't ride here tonight because it's due to go into the shop because I want their trained eyes to look for wear on the inside of the chambers.
So, what advice would you have, Jacob, for someone who wants to go on a really long ride? And what are the signs that something might be going wrong with your bike to the point where you think, like, maybe I should pull over and check on something? Like, are there any kind of warning signs? Are there things that you can kind of feel? I'm sure you know the signs better when you've been on the same ride or the same bike for a longer period of time as well. But you know, just make sure people stay safe out there and know, like, oh, I can probably limp it home, or maybe I shouldn't.
Yeah, no, that's a big thing. Part of it is, before you go on a big long ride, ride your bike often. You know, go for those afternoon runs. Learn your bike. Learn how it feels. The other thing is, if you are going to plan to gas stops, it's really worth your while to, when you realize you're about a mile out from a planned gas stop, just kind of mentally go through how the bike's feeling under you. A lot of riders, especially riders who go long distance, can get into like what is almost a runner's high for motorcyclists. And They've just adapted to whatever's the bike is doing and aren't noticing completely. They've just adapted and become one with whatever thing is going on. So pulling your head out of that rhythm you're in and getting that sense of, do my tires feel like maybe I need to check for air? Do, you know, is everything sounding right, et cetera, et cetera. And that way you're pulling into a gas station, and if it's something small like air in the tire, or you realize that when you're shifting, there's a little bit of chain slippage and you need to quick grab the wrench and adjust your slider to get chain tension back. You can do the small things in the parking lot real easy and prevent a bigger problem. However, you know, there are times where stuff happens that will instantly tell you you have a problem. One of the biggest ones, if you're that I've seen people ignore and end up getting into some big trouble, like being trapped in the middle of nowhere trouble, not crashing usually, but is suddenly their clutch starts feeling weird. When they're working their clutch lever, it's not responding the way they normally expect it to. And they go, I just have to adjust the tension next stop.
Yeah, that's a warning sign.
The moment your clutch starts to behave differently than you expect it to, whether it's suddenly becoming tighter or looser.
Or a grinding.
Pull over and start doing diagnostics. By the way, I am a big fan of becoming a member of the American Motorcycle Association. Their roadside assistance is stellar. I have never once had a problem, and I have actually been third party on a phone line when my AMA rep was screaming at a tow truck driver that no, he was going to spend the time to find me, even though he didn't think he was on the right road. So, you know, it's get roadside assistance, ride in groups, and pay attention to your ride, treat your ride well, do your pre-run maintenance on long trips, and pack some tools. I went out with a tool roll, as did all of my companions, and, you know, tire plugs in case of a flat tire, tools to fix minor problems, and AMA membership to get us when we need to get out of trouble.
It's all good advice. Thank you.
Now bringing this to the table, I'd like to open this with a bit of feedback. We actually got an email
following...
Yeah, following the Adventure Maximus character jam that we did.
Wait a minute. Sir Ham von Graveburglar.
Nathaniel, that means someone actually listens to the podcast?
Yeah, someone other than Greg.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So thanks, Greg, for telling our friend about this. We got an email from Francis James Hogan, who is the creator of Adventure Maximus, who has written us essentially to offer to run the game for us on the air sometime.
Sweet!
So the actual creator of one of our character jams found our episode and liked it enough to actually write us and offer to run a game.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have to make this happen.
Yeah, he called out the characters by name and everything. I think that would be fantastic.
Can you read a little excerpt for us?
What's that?
You can read an excerpt
for us? Oh, yeah. I should probably do that. Hi, B-Dab. Francis James Hogan here, creator, writer, and illustrator of Adventure Maximus.
What?
A bit behind, but I just heard your latest character jam and was pleased as punch to discover you were making Adventure Maximus characters. If you'd ever like to have a run through the game, I'd be glad to sit in as a Maximus Master.
What?
Or as a player and get the boozy Swayze, Sir Ham von Graveburglar, and Methafinil Hot Date on their first adventure.
He did call us out by name. That's great. Oh,
Jesus.
He also says, and this is my favorite part, screw Tales from the Loop. It's awesome. Just kidding. You should play hole.
No.
We might have something coming for you there, James. Francis, yeah. We might have something coming for you.
You're a bad man.
Bad, bad man. I was liking you so much, and then you decided hole had to happen. Oh, man.
Well.
Why do you hate me?
Bringing this. Thank you for writing us, Francis. Much appreciated. Your game looks great. We love it. We would love to play it sometime.
What's the name of the game again?
Adventure Maximus.
Where can you find it?
At your game store, which is where I bought it.
Yeah, excellent. Local game store.
Guardian Games, friendly local game store.
Yeah.
I do all my gaming shopping at Guardian Games and a few others. But Guardian is you know, a number one stop.
And those people there are so helpful. I mean, just the most amazing people there. The great staff, great selection. The few times I've gone there, they've just been like, oh, this is exactly what you want. You want this game. Here you go. And then I go home and I go, I didn't know I wanted that game. But I did. I did want that game.
We do have a topic to get to at some point.
Yes.
But I will agree, every time I have gone in there, I've either been looking, I've either been visibly questioning what I'm seeing on the shelf, or I will ask someone. But usually, I'll just be walking around, I'll have this pensive look on my face, and I'm usually holding my chin. And someone comes up, it's like, hi, can I help you find something? I'm like, yeah, I think you can. Tell me. Are there any good two-player games? Or I need a game based in colonial America. Or I need something to fit a theme. And they're like, I got you covered, bro. Right over here.
In the future, we got to do a bit on Guardian Games. We should even ask Angel May to swing by and, you know, guest host on that one.
Oh, she would be wonderful
and
to have on the mic.
She'd do it in a heartbeat.
Yep.
So, especially if we tell her booze is involved.
We should maybe even think about doing a live broadcast from there.
Ooh.
That would be fun.
That could be fun. They have a bar in the back,
by the way.
I frequently ride my motorcycle there. Critical All three sip. Covered. Boom.
Ooh, boom. Critical sip for the win.
Okay, anyway, we do have a topic, and that topic is... In role-playing game character creation, the concept of buying your character with points versus rolling your character randomly. It's a contentious topic.
Yes.
What do you prefer, Xander?
So I think of all of the characters that I've created, the one that I liked the most, because I felt like it wasn't like my fate was left to the gods of chance, that I felt that I was able to actually do exactly what I wanted to do in creating the character, was when I created Mecha DuPont for Shadowrun.
That's a good character.
And I appreciated that because the character system for Shadowrun specifically enables you to go and take a lot of negative things, which to me fleshes out your character more. But then you can use that to go and then build and put more points towards things that you actually want to have that are better about your character.
Now, some people would argue that the concept of taking a negative to give you more positive could lead to min-maxed characters. The characters that are built to focus singularly on one thing by buying a whole bunch of flaws that the GM's never going to use. Free points, you know. But you didn't do that. And no. Personally, I hate that. I hate it when people do that.
I agree, but I also had you as a GM, and you as a GM goes, oh, those are your flaws you're taking?
I shall always remember the player in a Shadowrun game I was GMing who gave their character an allergy to bee stings. They did not know insect spirits were a thing.
Insect spirits are from my favorite storyline and eventually my favorite source book of the entire Shadowrun canon.
Bug City, baby!
Bug City, yeah. Anyway, point buy is strong in Shadowrun. Shadowrun is a fantastic example of, well, at least in the modern version. Yeah, actually from the beginning it's been point buy, but they had this weird priority system where you set your points. It's hard to explain real quick on the air, so check out Shadowrun First Edition sometimes, folks. Just give it a shot one day. We might actually do it in a character jam. But
again, I like the system because you were great as a GM, because anytime someone took a flaw, you made it bite them in the ass at the end. I didn't realize taking a cat phobia was going to be so awful. But you try being the drone rigger left in the van in an alleyway.
Taking a cat phobia basically tells the GM, make a cat shaman as a villain.
Or send the Jaguar guard after you.
Yeah.
Or the time, or because I think I took moderate alcoholism, and then we went and raided a boat in the Willamette River, and we were, it was a cruise ship, and we were faking being the caterers, and of course, you decided to make me the bartender, which happened to be stocked with my favorite alcohol. And because I also took very low willpower,
Yeah. Well, suddenly the Decker is no longer available for this mission. Jacob, what about you?
I go both ways on this. I am bi-systemical. I like random roll. I like point buy.
So that is the way you roll.
That is the way I roll. I like them both because both have their points. I would never want to do random roll for a game as complicated and as potentially fatal as Shadowrun.
Why not? Why not?
Because for really complex games, everything being really random, you can look at your character and go, well, this guy is not going to last the first, session, and it's going to be because the firefight is going to take all night.
And here's your red shirt.
And here's your goddamn red shirt. Oh, look, I randomly rolled a street samurai who has no endurance or whatever the hell it is. The fighter with zero hit points or whatever. And so for really complicated games, or games that really depend on teams with very defined roles, I like point buy. However, for quick fun games like old school D&D clones, riffs, as long as you're thinning them out down a little bit, that sort of thing, a random roll is great. It allows you to quickly hammer out some characters and get going.
So I think that's actually a really excellent point for something that is super complex, where you have a really strong idea in your mind of the character that you really want to play. Point system is to me the only way to go. But I've also, especially in character jams we've done here, created some pretty funny characters because of the randomness of just rolling your character. And like, oh, well, okay, well, if I have this high of a strength and this low of an intelligence and this is my charisma, oh, I have a great idea now. But in some of those games I've played, too, I haven't really cared what I was going to play. I didn't have something really specific in mind. So when you have specific character traits and things you want to do, the randomness doesn't work. But as you say, for a quick fun game or I really don't care, I'll just make it up as I go along. I think the rolling system is perfectly adequate and can lead to some things you might not have expected, like Jebediah the Farmer, for instance.
Mm-hmm. One of my things that I point out as being really great for random roll is Warhammer Fantasy. I mean, there's this implied group buy-in to the concept that you have no control over who you were yesterday. It's from your first day as an adventuring party on that you have control over. So the fact that your stats are mostly random and your profession is I'm a rat catcher.
I love that about Warhammer.
It's... And that's what I love about Warhammer, too, because it feels so much more real in that case, where it is people from every walk of life, from all different circumstances, who are either forced to decide, forced to break their social convention, or to figure out a way to break their social strata.
I love that about Warhammer, because, like you said, you start the game playing the people that you were. And now you play the game to figure out who you are about to become.
Right.
And to me, first off, I'm just going to preface this by saying, dear GMs, I am the worst player. I suck as a player. I have been GMing for too long, and I simply chafe under the confines of being a player. Which is why when I run games, I try and give the players more options. I'm like, you tell me what happens. You tell me the cool thing that you do, and we'll see if everything can work it out. I don't like playing a lot of games that tell you, no, you can't do this because of this rule or no, whatever. I am a career game master because I have such extreme attention deficit hyperactivity disorder that for me to truly excel at my favorite hobby, I have to be mentally juggling 17 different plates, and I love doing it as a GM. As a player, I only get to juggle one, and it really just, I go nuts, and I can't do it. So that said, when I do get to play, I still prefer character generation to be randomly rolled, because Pathfinder is a fantastic example of the worst kind of character generation for me. Pathfinder is it's a fucking point buy system. You don't randomly roll your stats, even though it has rules for it. Mm-hmm. You would never randomly roll your stats in something like Pathfinder. You sit down, you pick what you're going to do. You pick your class, you pick your race, you assign your stat points as you wish. You assign your feats, you assign your skill points, and then you essentially predetermine your character's entire life from that point forward. Right. And right. Things like Shadowrun are kind of the same. I guess I could play Shadowrun, but with Shadowrun, Pathfinder, any of those games that have so many choices and a lot of and no randomness, I feel smothered in choice.
I have to say that class-based systems end up being really problematic with point buy.
The reason that I like point buy better, just in general, is that in most role-playing games, you are not playing Joe fucking Schmo, who just is nobody, for the most part. You are in the game because you have some kind of special, unique gift, ability. You know, in every D&D game, you are the hero class world full not of ordinary always. People. No, but generally speaking, like, you're off to go adventure while you leave the peasants behind, is what I was trying to get at with that.
It depends on what flavor you're going for.
Sure.
In modern D&D, you are the hero from the beginning. In classic D&D, you are the zero who becomes the hero.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. Yeah. It's yeah. just interesting how that perspective has changed over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I would say that as you're building a character, you know, in every game I've played, you walk around the people who are the NPCs because they're just not as good as you. And you can randomly roll a character that would be, like, worse than your average NPC on the street mm-hmm. just because of the randomness. And at that point, like, well, why am I even in this party? I'm going to get everybody killed. But that mm-hmm. could be fun, too. But you would never have that person in your party to begin with, either.
So let me talk for a moment, Xander, about Dungeon Crawl Classics, which is a game that I'm trying to get you to join us to play.
Yes.
Dungeon Crawl Classics takes that, laser focuses on it, and then flips it upside down, in that you sit down, not just with one, you don't sit down with a character that you come to the table wanting to play. Instead, you sit down with three or four 100% down the line randomly rolled characters, complete with background, starting equipment, nothing is predetermined, and then you see who survives the first dungeon. And oftentimes, the results will surprise you, and you'll end up with a vastly more interesting character than you possibly could have conceived before the game. I want to give an example. Jacob is in my weekly game of the American Survival Guide, which is a campaign setting based on Dungeon Crawl Classics. 100% random characters.
Yeah.
The most interesting character to date in the game is also the shittiest one in the group, and his name is Drew.
Fuck Drew.
Drew somehow became a wizard. He now has a snake tongue, a lisp, he fucks up his spells half the time, and he has the worst stats. He doesn't actually have a bonus in anything, and I think his highest stat is at a 9. Drew, however, has consistently ended up in the most hilarious of situations, always survives, rolls the most crits for some reason, and is the luckiest son of a bitch in the game. He has become the most legendary character in the group. There are other characters who are vastly more proficient than him, but Drew has become something of, at least to me, the mascot of the group. And it was 100% random. None of this... He was just some schmuck who escaped from a debtor's prison. His weapon is a broken chain. And then he became a wizard.
Oh, Lincoln wants to have words with that man in a dark corner one of these days.
Yeah.
That just kind of sounds like the wizard from the Discworld series. The guy who just doesn't make spells very well. And
Rincewind.
Yes. Yeah. 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 No, Rincewind is far too competent in comparison.
Oh, yeah. Rincewind is far too competent. Drew's just more like, I'm going to press this button. And somehow survives. And learns another spell in the process.
We're at the point now where if we get a hint that Drew's trying to cast a spell, everybody dives for cover.
No, guys, I got this.
I love the way that we used to, back in the day, use random rolls to divine who you were about to play. Mm-hmm. You didn't come to the table thinking, I'm going to play Lanthrus Elfblaster, the elite hunter with a pet jaguar. You sat down, you rolled the dice, and you looked at the dice and said, what can I play with this? I'm going to get some ideas. And that led to some very interesting characters. I have binders full of those characters.
And that is the fun of the random roll system. And then there's the taking that to the extreme, aka Traveler, which is your first session of 4 hours is running through all the phases of the character's life during which they may or may not die, all of which are determined by random rolls.
Speaking of random rolls, we might have to at some point come back to our favorite chart-based character creation system to date.
Oh, no.
Oh,
no, yes. Not again. Not again, please.
Final thoughts on this? We're running out of time here. This is a topic that we could probably talk for hours about. So cramming it into 15 to 20 minutes probably wasn't the best idea.
We could always touch on it again later, especially if we get some feedback from our legions of listeners out there.
But yeah. Greg and Francis, tell us what you think about point buy versus random. We'd love to hear from you. And any of your friends who are also listening, thanks.
Thanks.
Xander.
Oh, yeah.
What's our topic today?
Our topic tonight is going to be smoking in bars.
I remember those days.
I remember those days, too. And then depending on where you travel in this country, you can still live them. I think we tried to figure out when the smoking ban was passed on one of our last episodes. It was somewhere around 2009 or something like that. And I remember I was in the Yamhill Public House, probably the most notorious dive bar that still exists in downtown Portland, on the eve of the passing of that, or the eve of the enacting of that, rather, on New Year's Eve. And right at midnight, you know, everyone cheered and then they just kept smoking because no one gave a shit because it's the Yamhill Pub. do you have the answer for us?
Nope, not yet.
Oh, fact checking on the fly.
Colorado is not Oregon.
Fact. That is a geographic fact. So I'm kind of two minds about it because on one end, I don't particularly like government telling small businesses what they can or cannot do.
The government.
Government. And mostly because I felt that most bars, especially in this city, were voluntarily going smoke-free anyways.
A number of them, but the ones that I wanted to hang out at the most, unfortunately, were not.
No, they were pry it out of their cold, dead hands is basically what a lot of my favorite dive bars were like as well. However, I did notice a very strong trend since when I was able to go to bars here. To the actual smoking ban itself. A number of my favorite dive bars also, too, going to be smoke-free just voluntarily. So, to me, the trend was heading in that direction, and if the trend is heading in that direction, I don't necessarily see a need to have it be enforced all the way because of a law, especially because most bartenders that I knew at these bars chain-smoked while they worked anyways. So it's not like the health of the bartender was a really good reason at most of these places because that's just what they did.
I will say that if you are at a restaurant and or a bar, smoking should not be allowed by the people mixing your drinks and making your food or handling your food. They should have to take smoke breaks. I'm sorry. Even if the clientele can do it, I don't want your fucking cigarette ash in my drink, in my scrambled eggs, or on my plate.
Somebody's got standards around here.
I like cleanliness in food service and drink
service. Anyone's going to get ash in my drink, it's going to be me.
It's going to be me.
Not your stupid menthol ash.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with menthols.
divisive topic.
Ooh, all right. Well, shots fired.
I did frequent karaoke bars for a long time, and I was, before Portland put in the smoking ban in bars, I frequented Chopsticks, and Chopsticks was the karaoke place to go.
Yeah.
Problem was, the place stank of cigarettes, and even though that I was a smoker at the time, I still didn't like going into a place and just coming out, like, just the coating everything. There was one non-smoking karaoke bar in town, and that was the Ambassador, and it sucked. And it still sucks. I always hated the Ambassador. Their thing was, you know, what they got people in the door with at the time was that they were non-smoking. Like, that was what they advertised. I wonder how they get people in the door now.
Well, it's not for the fact that they charge you like $3 when you order a soda water at the bar, because that was some straight up bullshit last time I was there.
Now, the last time I went, they had a cover.
Oh my God.
The last time I tried to go, which was the only time since the smoking ban, I do not pay a cover at a karaoke bar. I will pay for private room karaoke, but the Ambassador is not private room karaoke.
I will pay a drink limit for karaoke, but I will not pay a cover.
I will pay for someone else to have a drink limit at karaoke. But that's going into our previous episode.
Yeah, last topic.
With one exception, there is one karaoke bar in town that I will pay a cover for, but it's not, it's a complicated.
But, I mean, to me, the first time I went into the Yamhill Public House, when it was no longer a smoking bar, it just didn't feel like the Yamhill anymore. It wasn't the Yamhole. It actually kind of went back to the Yamhill afterwards. Because you used to not be able to see across the bar. And that was part of the charm. Because the smoke was so thick. If you forgot your cigarettes, you could just lick the walls and you'd be fine. Because there was so much nicotine coating them.
Just don't lick the floors, people.
Oh, God, no. And part of that reason is, for me, I'm sorry I've thrown up on your floors, Yamhill. I'm sorry. You know, I get it. It's bad for people. Probably shouldn't be around it that much. The smell is awful. But I've also been in massive casinos, which have had the ability just to like suck smoke out so fast and so well.
Yeah.
That you can't even tell. Or like, unless the person's sitting next to you.
Yeah, I don't think the Yamhill can afford that filtration system.
But yeah. I also think that in my philosophy of running a business, do what they want to do, that, you know, they have that option available of like, if you can get, you know, this grade filtration system, like, knock yourself out.
There were a number of bars at the time when the ban went through that continued to pay the fine for a short period of time, but I think that it got too much.
There was also a few clubs that operated as a private club, quote unquote, that were after hour bars. So basically you would pay $35 to get into this club. They would hand you a couple tickets. You would use that ticket and hand it to someone randomly who would then give you a very stiff drink. So they weren't selling alcohol after hours. They were giving it to you for this piece of paper. And you could smoke whatever the fuck you wanted up there because it was a private after hours club.
Does that still happen?
Yes.
I don't know of any places. So you will have to chat at when the microphones are turned off.
Yeah. And so that was the thing that happened for a while, which again, I thought was fine. There was also a point, I believe it was in Minnesota, when they had imposed a smoking ban, which, as you might imagine, in the dead of winter, went over like a turned a punch bowl, because apparently it gets really cold in the winter in Minnesota. Am I correct about this, Jacob?
Yeah, it gets slightly nippy. Yeah,
tidbit nipply out there in the wintertime. Yeah, so
you got to do up your top button.
So apparently a bunch of Minnesotans who had been, you know, smoking in bars for years were a little bit upset about having to go outside to smoke a cigarette in the like negative 30 degree weather.
Yes.
And so a couple bars declared their bars to be live action theatrical productions.
Yep.
Because almost every single smoking ban in every state that has enacted them so far have a caveat that if it is for a stage production, you can smoke a cigarette on stage if it's part of act, if it's an act or part of artwork or something like that, yep. some kind of theatrical production. And so this bar declared that everybody that walked into the bar itself was now an extra in this ongoing experimental play.
That's weird. How did that work out?
Pretty well for a while.
Yeah, that first year when the smoking ban went in Minnesota, was it was the wild, wild west. The state ended up having to redo the entire smoking law because the way the penalties were structured in it, because Minnesota was actually one of the second wave of states that did it, were that there was a whole bunch of bars in my hometown that would continue to allow smoking. And people would come in and find the bar, and the bar would pay it and go each and every time in the memo line of the check, write in the amount of business we have gained is over double the amount of this fine. And there was a whole bunch of bar owners who did that, and they eventually had to redo the entire smoking law to do this escalating thing and potentially threaten your liquor license.
Yeah. Okay. On the one hand, I understand.
It's cold in Minnesota.
It's cold in Minnesota. Here's something, guys. You should just stop smoking. Eh? Imagine the money that the individuals would save and the bars would save on cleanliness, on all those things that go in if everyone just stopped. That is, it's crazy talk.
You could say the same thing about just not going to bars.
I mean, literally you could say the same thing about alcohol.
Yeah, the health, the alcohol, the public good of just banning alcohol. I mean, I don't think it's ever gone wrong in this country before.
Yeah, but one of them actually gives you, lets you drown away your tears and socialize. The other is just nothing but poison. There's no, I'm sorry, when I first started smoking, I remember getting like a buzz, and that was like kind of the allure, and then you just stopped, and then it stopped happening, and then it just became an addiction, a crutch. But when I drink, you know, that's my social lubricant. Suddenly my personality is turned on, like here with you.
My personal experience is very different from yours in that regard then.
I mean, you've even said, you know, talking about gaming as therapy and how, you know, like one smoke break turns into like 10 as talk to somebody outside. So it seems like that's a contradiction to your own point.
Oh, no. Don't get me wrong. I still occasionally smoke and I enjoy a vape. I'm just saying that all of these people that have a problem with the smoking ban, like the smoking ban does go into place for a reason, and it is for public health. And sure. These people who are like, how dare you want me to be healthy? Come on, folks. Like, instead of trying to figure out how to work around it, maybe just stop for a second and think, you know, I could smoke less. I really could. And I could encourage the people that I love that come in on a regular basis and hang out at my establishment. I could maybe encourage them to be just a little bit healthier and also smell better.
Or like right before Minnesota put through the smoking ban, Tim Carmody at Carmody's Irish Pub in Duluth put in the cigar and pipe hours. The bar was smoke-free until after 9 o'clock at night, and then you were allowed to smoke inside the bar as long as you were smoking a cigar or a pipe.
Then you could encourage them to be cultured.
In that weird Irish sort of way that involves singing off-key and occasionally punching each other.
Yay. That's,
you know, I will drink to singing off-key and punching each other.
But to me, the thing that upsets me about so many of these types of things, you know, when public policy gets involved, is that what they didn't ban in almost every state that had these were cigar rooms.
Yep.
Because poor people don't smoke cigars. Rich assholes who can afford fucking 20-year, 30-year scotch smoke cigars, and they want to keep smoking cigars indoors where it's comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things were not banned, and you cannot make an argument that one is worse than the other. Because they're both awful. Just one is done more by rich people, and one is done more by poor people. So even in these instances, it was classist, straight up.
Yep.
I'm sorry, poor people, you don't get the opportunity to have a cigarette and get the stress off because you're not rich enough to enjoy high-end scotch.
You also live in a rental unit, which we've outlawed smoking in. You also live in areas with dense urban crowding, or so you're more likely to be within 10 feet of a door to a building, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
That's fair.
By the way, everything I just said also applies to marijuana in this state, so...
Personally, I think it stinks. All of it. Cigarettes, cigars, marijuana, and frankly, I'm glad that you can no longer do them in bars. A funny story is, although you say that it is that classes, most places that allowed smoking inside did not allow cigars or pipes.
Idiots.
That's true, because they probably... Well, I guess I would question how big of a deal was that, though.
It was a huge deal. For people that wanted to smoke a cigar.
Yeah, it was a huge deal.
Okay. If you go to a bar, most likely you were not allowed to smoke a cigar. They were restricted to cigar rooms. You could smoke one on the porch, but even then, a lot of places were like, nope, you can't smoke that here because it stinks.
Yeah, when the smoking effect went into effect 2009 here in Oregon, I went out on the patio of one of the local bars. Now, I don't mind that Oregon has banned smoking in bars because they, unlike many states, still allow smoking on smoking patios.
Yeah, and I like that I don't have to dry clean my jacket when I get home.
And for places like the Nightlight over on 21st in the Southeast.
Clinton.
Yeah, on Clinton.
Yeah.
Which the difference between their patio and an enclosed room is so questionable, But... I fired up a cigar out there and was promptly told I couldn't smoke it out there. And I'm like, excuse me? I mean,
Is this or is this not a smoking patio?
I mean, now I've had people cut me a lot of slack when I've lit up a pipe after they've confirmed I wasn't smoking marijuana in it, which I understand. But
that's a legal issue. Let's clarify that for our listeners.
That's a legal issue, and their liquor license is at stake there. But when I'm pulling out the bag that includes my pipe, my roll of tobacco, my pipe knife, my pipe cleaners, and all of the accoutrement for pipe smoking, you know, it's a production, and they usually figure out, oh, he's smoking a pipe. And most people, surprisingly enough, don't mind pipe smoke.
Well, it does smell a lot better than pretty much anything else.
It smells a lot better than every single cigar I've ever smelled in my life.
Yeah.
And we actually have a lot of hookah bars here.
Which, again, is still weird to me.
We had them in the South, too. It was something I was so used to. Yeah.
Hookah bars in the South.
Yeah. Wow. The South is a surprisingly diverse area, Xander.
I know. I've been there before.
Okay.
I just never saw a hookah bar in my travels. Oh.
Well, yeah, I could show you some.
I'd love to see them. That would be great.
Of course, they're not popular in Minnesota outside the Twin Cities, but that's because why on earth would you want to smoke and not be able to drink at the same time?
I will say that I got spoiled after the smoking ban here in Portland. I got used to a few things, and one is that in Portland, you cannot smoke in bars, and thanks to the OLCC, any bar or establishment that serves hard liquor also has to have a menu. Now, that there are many ways to work around that menu, but they have certain rules that must be followed. The OLCC can check in. There has to be food available to eat.
A minimum amount of substantial and different unique food items, I believe is the exact word, is unique food items.
Well, I know a number of places that do not follow that rule and just have one thing, and they have, I think their unique food items are, we have the Stouffer's chicken nuggets, we have the Kraft chicken nuggets, and we have the Safeway chicken nuggets. On the microwave, you get to pick which one.
Or my favorite was Kelly's Olympian back in the day when you had your choice of three pre-made sandwiches that were pre-made by the staff ahead of time on white bread. You could get like ham with mustard, roast beef with mayonnaise, or something with something. And that was it.
They have a really good menu today,
I must say. They have a really good menu.
What I was getting at here is that I got spoiled by this, being able to go to a bar, not have to smell like cigarettes, and also be able to have food.
Yeah.
When I went back to my home state of Alabama, and sister's like, hey, let's go to my favorite dive. It's like, oh, yeah, even at a dive bar, there will be food. So we go, and it's just the worst fucking booze ever, the stinkiest place ever, and no food. I was so sad because I realized I was a spoiled Pacific Northwesterner.
And that was funny, too, because the first time I went to Orlando, it was kind of the same thing where, one, because there was no OLCC or any equivalent to that in the state, you were able to get shots of Evan Williams Green Label for $2, but it had to be on the rocks. That was the only rule. And I thought, for $2, I can get pretty drunk for $10. This is a great state. And then again, no food in the venue, which again, you know, the small government guy inside of me is not opposed to that because I don't think you should be forced to have a kitchen because that's expensive and there's a lot of food waste involved. But also every bar outside had food carts that would pull up and sell people on the street food. So again, the free market kind of went and settled that issue in that particular area.
Well, smoking in bars, I miss it, but I don't. I miss being able to sit down and have a drink and have a cigarette. But at the same time, the patio's right there. I can just walk out and have the cigarette.
But the OLCC cracked down on that recently as well.
They cracked down on the people that didn't bribe them enough. There are a number of bars that have outdoor patios that are almost fully enclosed that get away with it.
Yeah.
And then there's a number of other bars
that don't,
that had really low walls and almost no roof whatsoever over the patio that for some reason, they didn't bribe the OLCC enough, deemed to be enclosed and forced to be torn down.
Yeah.
Right.
The OLCC
but
is
they made that regulation
corrupt.
Yep.
Group. They made that regulation. That was not something that was previously
correct.
On there.
That was not part of the
so they made it and then they enforced it on their
people
own
that
volition.
Didn't pay them.
Right.
Yeah.
Because Union Jacks, they still have the fully enclosed patio that they get away with somehow.
Yep.
Well, as smaller clubs that can't afford to bribe them had to take their patios down.
Mm-hmm. Or places like Sassy's, which now goes in bars smoking outside.
Yeah. Yep.
Not that anyone cares or pays attention to that.
Yep. Yep.
But they had to stop.
We've gone on for way too long on this topic.
We just say fuck the OLCC.
Fuck the OLCC.
Fuck the OLCC.
I had someone try to convince me that they did some good, and they do. They do encourage variety at liquor stores. Because of the OLCC, you can go to any liquor store in the state and be insured to have a variety of options. Whereas in many other states, Alabama, for example, you can go to liquor stores and they basically only carry the top five brands and that's it. Whereas at least in Oregon, I'm glad that I can go to a liquor store and buy something local.
Do you think that the mentality of trying something new and different is different in Alabama than it is in Portland, Oregon?
Boy, you shut your mouth.
And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we'll close out this segment.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol, get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again.
Well, we are at least a couple shots and one, if not two beers each in on the, what was it again?
George Dickel Tennessee Sour Mash Whiskey, Superior Recipe number 12, distilled and charcoal mellowed at George A. Dickel and Company in Tullahoma, Tennessee.
And?
Everybody's Brewing Local Lager Lager. Brewed here in White Salmon, Washington, right down the gorge and across the river.
Yeah, so if you've ever been to Hood River in the state, they're just right across the bridge.
I do love Hood River. It is a wonderful place for wineries. It's got a great selection of local restaurants, and I think Full Sail.
Full Sail is there. Double Mountain Brewing is there. I think there's Horse Feather.
Yep, there's a lot of good places.
Up on the hill. Who make a
Cathedral Ridge.
A brown coat themed beer. Ooh. From Firefly.
Oh, nice.
And they actually have the flag of the Independence next to the beer, which I thought was excellent.
Goddamn brown coats. Burp your belly pride forever. But yeah,
coat's
no.
Coat's looking a little brown over there.
But jump the river and go over to White Salmon. There's White a couple really good wineries on that side of the river and some great bars. It's
and everybody's brewing is over there.
And yep. If you're from Oregon and you do go over there, be sure to keep your ID handy so you don't have to pay sales tax.
That's right, kids. Yeah. That's a smart move, actually.
Yeah, it's one of the perks that we get as Oregonians.
Being really close to the border, yeah.
We'll come back to that point in the future, but...
Hey, those people come over here and work at our places and don't have to pay income taxes.
Okay. That's true.
So I'm not going to pay sales tax when I go to fucking Vancouver.
I agree with you on the bigger principle you're stating there.
There is no bigger principle.
Should you always tip your bartender, Xander?
You should always tip your bartender.
Well, then, maybe...
Is that voluntary or is... Sorry.
The thing is that it is voluntary for you to request not paying sales tax because you're an Oregon resident. However, many of the point of sale machines on the Washington side make it very difficult for the person processing your transaction to not include sales tax. And so you're being kind of a...
Oh, no. They have to press 3 more buttons on the screen.
They have to fill out an extra form. Oh.
As somebody who
Do you want
goes
my business
over,
or not?
As somebody who goes over to Walgreens in Vancouver frequently to so I could buy legally the good Sudafed.
Yeah.
The process. It's like 3 buttons and a site and a thing I have to sign.
Yep.
So it's not so bad. I would never do this in Seattle because I do not expect them to know or care.
They don't care.
They don't care.
Give a fuck.
But I know that there are agreements of some kind where in Washington, I think it's a legal thing. We'll look it up and maybe post links or talk about it at length later. Jacob.
Yes.
So this is episode 10. We've been doing this for 10 episodes.
We have 10 episodes?
Character jams.
10 episodes.
10 episodes. Holy cow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some other podcasts have hundreds, but we've been doing this for 10
quality,
episodes.
Not quantity, NPC.
I agree, my friend. Let's clink on that. No, let's get some clink.
Yeah.
10 episodes of talking about 3 intersecting topics and getting drunk.
And getting drunk.
That's a plus.
That's a plus.
I think we got something good here, and I'm looking forward to 10 more.
Yeah.
At least.
10 more beers.
Ten more beers.
Oh. Or liquors, or wines, or guests.
Yes.
Many more topics.
We do actually have some fun guests planned in the pipeline for you all, so you're going to have to go in.
We got to get Skip on here, the amazing musician behind our creation.
Yeah, our awesome theme song. I did talk to Skip in the last couple weeks in person as well, and he is super interested in being a part of our show. And perhaps our listener, Greg, can, and Francis, can let us know what character jam you want Skip Von Kusky to be a part of.
And Francis Hogan, thanks again for sending us the awesome correspondence. We'd love to get you on if you listen to this. Again, let me know, and we'll make that happen.
And we always love and appreciate your feedback. As you see, we will read it on the air.
Yes, we will.
And respond back to it on the air.
Yes.
iTunes reviews, direct feedback. We have forms on our website. We are present on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Google. We even have a Discord community. Not that many people are on it, but we're there waiting to hear from you if you ever want to hang out and chat.
And shortly, we will have a line community as well.
A what?
We'll talk later.
Yes, that too. Anyway, folks, let us know what you think. If you've got any topics that you want to hear us discuss, if you have any drinks that you want to hear us review, we actually don't do that much drink review other than, yeah, I like it, or no, I don't. But we're definitely
This was a
down.
Good one this time.
This is a good one.
We're definitely down to give more drink feedback, to talk about the things that you want to hear. Anyway.
And if you're a local brewery and want us to review your beer live on the air.
Yes, we will.
We'll talk. Yeah. Anyway, as always, you've been listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. I'm Nathaniel.
I'm just Jacob.
And Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And as always, we want to remind you
rubber side down.
And may your dice always roll crits.
Always tip your bartender.
And always drink responsibly. Thanks for listening, folks.
Thanks.
See you next time.
Thanks for joining us, friend. We've reached the end of Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your car. The Bikers, Dice, and Bars.